Sehr geehrte Frau Rektorin, mittlerweile nämlich eingetroffen aus einer langen Sitzung, sehr geehrter Herr Dekan, liebe Aretha van Herk, liebe Kolleginnen und Kollegen, Mitarbeiterinnen und Mitarbeiter, Doktorandinnen, Ex-Doktorandinnen und Doktoranden, Studierende und ehemalige, liebe Festgäste. Zunächst bedanke ich mich beim Dekan, bei Silvia Mergenthal und Aretha van Herk und besonders auch natürlich bei der Laudatorin Caroline Rosenthal für ihre so überaus freundlichen Worte und auch zum Teil fürs Anreisen von weit her. Aber ich freue mich, Sie alle hier zu sehen, zumal an einem Montag zu späterer Stunde, zumal in der zweiten Semesterwoche, die meist noch Semesteranfangs imponderabilien und in jedem Fall viel Arbeit beinhaltet. Nach 30 Jahren Professorendasein und weiß ich nur zu gut, wie man sich derartige Extratermine aus der Arbeitsflut herausangeln muss und dann vielleicht als unliebsame Konsequenz um 5 Uhr morgens aufsteht, um zum Beispiel noch eine Lehrveranstaltung des Tages gut vorbereitet zu bekommen. Insofern weiß ich euer und ihr hier sein wirklich sehr zu schätzen. Umso mehr gilt dies für diejenigen, die von weiter her gekommen sind. Nur einige wenige der Angereisten seien stellvertretend erwähnt. Den Vogel hat Aretha van Herk abgeschossen. Zwischen Calgary und Zürich liegen hin und zurück knapp 16.000 Kilometer Luftlinie und 19 Stunden reine Flugzeit. Das Aufbringen solcher Zeit- und Reisestrapazen durch eine vielbeschäftigte Schriftstellerin ist ein riesiges Geschenk, liebe Aretha, für das ich ganz herzlich Danke sage. Meine langjährige Kollegin in der Anglistik hier, Aleida Assmann, wohnt zwar in fußläufiger Entfernung von unserer Uni, aber bei Aleida weiß man nie, von woher sie gerade angereist ist. Und so schrieb mir Aleida am Ende ihrer kürzlichen Zusagemail auch: ganz herzliche Grüße zurzeit aus Köln. Ich möchte bei der Gelegenheit auch noch einmal Aleida und auch Jan Assmann gewiss im Namen aller hier ganz herzlich zu ihrem jüngsten Premiumpreis, dem Friedenspreis des Deutschen Buchhandels, ganz herzlich gratulieren. Mein erster Doktorand an der Uni Konstanz, Bruno Arich Gerz, ist aus dem Rheinland angereist. Er ist wissenschaftlicher Mitarbeiter an der Uni Wuppertal und unter einem Pseudonym Romanautor. Diese Zusammenarbeit damals war auch deshalb passend, weil wir beide, wie es der Zufall wollte, aus Köln stammen. Übrigens ist die sprichwörtliche, unverwüstliche, rheinische Frohnatur auch an der Uni manchmal ganz hilfreich. Aus Baden-Baden ist meine 11. hiesige Doktorandin angereist, Nicola Müntefering, es war zu spät, mit ihrem Mann Volker Janitz. Direkt nach ihrem Einser-Examen in den Fächern Englisch und Politik hatte Nicola ein Praktikum beim SWR absolviert. So kam es, dass sie noch während ihrer Promotionszeit Moderatorin bei SWR 3 wurde, dem meistgehörten öffentlich-rechtlichen Radioprogramm Deutschlands. Dass sie ihre Promotion trotz forderndem Beruf schließlich 2009 noch zu einem guten Abschluss brachte, ist imponierend. Und selbst der Südkurier nahm von diesem ungewöhnlichen Werdegang Notiz. Tja, so war das damals. Natürlich eine gestellte Szene. Also wir lesen da nicht Nicola Müntefering's Doktorarbeit, sondern in Margaret Atwood Works and Impact. Das stand da gerade. Ich habe diesen Zeitungsbericht kürzlich beim 100-stündigen Ausräumen meines Unibüros gefunden. wie so vieles andere, das bis zu 24 Jahre dort lagerte, aber zwischenzeitlich mental verschollen war. Und ich würdigte beim Ausräumen auch noch einmal diverse Antrittsgeschenke für mich von 1994, die die nächsten Dekaden mein Büro dekorierten. Eins davon ist ein Poster eines Gemäldes, das mir Gabriele Metzler, auch heute hier, schenkte, als ich 1994 von Freiburg an den Bodensee wechselte. So kam es, wie ich öfters von Studierenden hörte, dass ich Monets Seerosenbild Generationen von Prüflingen eingebrannt hat, wenn sie in der liminalen Phase der mündlichen Prüfung nachdenkend auch auf dieses Bild direkt hinter ihrer Prüferin schauten. Es blieb ihnen gar nichts anderes übrig. Beim Büroausräumen stieß ich auch auf die Papiere, auf denen ich sämtliche Anmeldungen zu mündlichen Prüfungen bei mir an der Uni Konstanz erfasst habe. Ein Blatt pro Person. Das Ordnen all dieser Blätter erforderte aufgrund der Papiermenge ungewöhnliche Arbeitsmethoden. Immerhin wurde so zutage gefördert, dass ich allein an der Uni Konstanz in 24 Jahren 659 mündliche Abschlussprüfungen abgehalten habe. Über 600 davon einstündige Prüfungen. Was ich nun zeige, existiert nicht mehr, denn ich habe es kürzlich komplett entsorgt. Sämtliche studentische Abschlussarbeiten, die ich als Professorin an den Universitäten Mainz, Freiburg und Konstanz erst betreut, gelesen und begutachtet habe, über 300 Arbeiten, es wurde ja eben schon angedeutet. Die allermeisten davon entstanden an der Uni Konstanz, weil ich in Mainz und Freiburg zuvor nur relativ kurz war. Bezeichnenderweise waren es diese Arbeitsberge, von denen ich mich beim Büroausräumen nur widerstrebend trennen konnte. Denn es war mir bewusst, welche Unmengen von Arbeit an erster Stelle von den Studierenden, aber auch von ihrer Betreuerin in diese Abschlussarbeiten geflossen waren, sodass die Betreuerin manchmal auch in der Arbeit, beziehungsweise hier den Arbeiten, unterzugehen schien. Die allermeisten Gutachten in Konstanz wurden von Frau Christine Schneider getippt auf mein Diktat hin. Und trotz der vielen Arbeit haben wir beide in über 15 Jahre langer, sehr guter Zusammenarbeit nicht das Lächeln und Lachen verlernt. Wo ist sie denn jetzt? Ach, da ist sie ja. Wie umsichtig Frau Schneider immer agierte, sah ich auch noch einmal nach dem bewältigten Ausräumen meines Unibüros, das dann, wie sie sagte, einen traurigen Anblick bot. 30.09.2018, ein Tag vor meiner Entpflichtung. Sie deutete an, dass sie sich für die Prüfungswoche, die ich noch einmal in diesem Büro abhalten würde, etwas einfallen lassen würde. Und so sah dies dann aus, als ich für die erste von 20 Staatsexamensprüfungen das von mir geräumte Büro betrat. Ich konnte es kaum fassen. Ich bedanke mich sehr herzlich bei Ihnen, liebe Frau Schneider, für die zuverlässige, sehr pflichtbewusste und so angenehme Mitarbeit über all die Jahre. Und da Sie gerne reisen, möchte ich Ihnen etwas Rüstzeug dafür überreichen, einen Rucksack gefüllt mit hoffentlich nützlichen Reiseutensilien. Dass er das Signum GA, großes A, großes G, großes A, unser beider interne Abkürzung für Gutachten trägt, braucht sie beim Wandern nicht zu belasten, ganz im Gegenteil, denn hier steht GA für die Firma, ganz passend, Global Agency. Das alles korreliert mit dem Titel meines kleinen persönlichen Vorspanns University Furnishings, den ich dem Titel einer Short Story der kanadischen Nobelpreisträgerin Alice Munro entlehnt habe, Family Furnishings. Furnishings bedeutet im Deutschen Dekoration, Möblierung, Einrichtung, Ausstattung. Im übertragenen Sinne bedeutet es in der Munro-Story auch das Rüstzeug, das die Familie der Ich-Erzählerin mit auf den Lebensweg gibt oder in Teilen gerade auch vorenthält, manchmal bewusst, manchmal unbewusst. Aus diesen Einflüssen und Impulsen ergibt sich schließlich ihr Berufswunsch Schriftstellerin. Nach Absolvierung eines eher unerfreulichen Familienbesuchs sitzt die Studentin auf dem Nachhauseweg in einem betriebsamen Drugstore allein über einer Tasse Kaffee und beobachtet die Menschen um sich herum. Such happiness to be alone, to see the hot late afternoon light on the sidewalk outside, the branches of a tree just out in leaf. I thought of the work I wanted to do. The cries of the crowd came to me like big heartbeats. Und nach weiteren Hinweisen auf die Bedeutung des Schreibens wie auch ihres lebensweltlichen Umfeldes für sie endet die Story so. This was what I wanted. This was what I thought I had to pay attention to. This was how I wanted my life to be. In Bezug auf meinen Beruf habe ich beides gleichermaßen genossen, die eintauchende Forschung und das Schreiben am Schreibtisch zu Hause, wie auch das Auftauchen in öffentliche Lehre, Ausforschung, den Austausch mit und die Betreuung von so vielen klugen, jungen, auch wunderbaren Menschen. Wenn die amerikanische Gesundheitspsychologin Kelly McGonigal von der Stanford University argumentiert, ein sinnhaftes Leben sei ein stressiges Leben, so ist mein Berufsleben überaus sinnhaft gewesen. Gleichwohl möchte ich in Zukunft verstärkt auch solche sinnhaften Aspekte des Lebens weiterverfolgen, die möglichst weniger von Zeitdruck begleitet werden. Dazwischen, vor dem Erreichen dieser neuen Lebensphase, liegt meine Abschiedsvorlesung und diese erfolgt jetzt. With again good wishes from Canada. This is, by the way, Survival Woman, a creation by Margaret Atwood. And Survival Woman is the counterpart to American Superman. So Survival Woman, for instance, wears snow boots or snow shoes rather than boots. And here Survival Woman says, in case you cannot read Atwood's handwriting, Rheingard, survive. I will, Margaret. I will. Ich habe gehört, einige haben auch den Roman gelesen. Allein das ist ja schon wunderbar. Also extra für diesen Termin, meine ich. In the broad field of American culture, scholars at the University of Constance and elsewhere have for decades taken note also of that other North American literature, Canadian literature. They have thus dealt with both American and Canadian literature and culture, either separately or transnationally, and in particular comparatively, that is, in the framework of comparative North American studies. It is against this backdrop that I would like to preface my lecture with a literary anecdote from Canada. In the final stages of the publication process of my monograph Comparative North American Studies, I contacted Margaret Atwood in 2015, requesting the copyright for several text extracts and pieces of visual arts from her works I intended to use in that book. She granted the copyright per email, as she had kindly done on every previous occasion. Yet upon informing my publisher, Palgrave Macmillan, of Atwood's assent, they wrote back saying that they require their official form to be signed by Atwood. So I emailed her again. Probably sensing my discontent about this cumbersome copyright procedure at the end of what had been a lengthy writing process, Atwood answered encouragingly and commented, "It's a complicated affair, our modern world of publishing." She added the link to a short video clip, a Norwegian piece with English subtitles called Medieval Help Desk, which catapults us back to medieval times, to the beginning of the Gutenberg era. The funny video clip shows a medieval monk asking an expert who is knowledgeable about the new medium of the book for help, because the monk does not have a clue how to handle and what to do with that strange new object, a book. So, wie kriege ich das jetzt zum Laufen? Zu Hause wüsste ich's. Fantastic. What would I be without my young students?
Ja,
the video treats the then new medium of the book as a material object, with medium-specific characteristics such as printed pages that can be turned in both directions, binding, the sequentiality of informational transmission. The video thereby underscores how any communicational medium has its own rules of reception, which the user, in this case the reader, first has to master. The clip is also relevant in the context of my present talk on Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Published in 1985, the novel arrived just 1 year after the date George Orwell had chosen for his 1984, the classical dystopian novel to which Atwood's has often been compared, frequently with the claim that hers is an even better novel. In The Handmaid's Tale, with its main part set in the 1990s in the former United States, Atwood offers a frightening view of the then near future. For instance, books are banned in public life, apart from the Bible, though only men may read from it, and particularly women, under penalty of having their hands cut off, are forbidden to read and write. The female population thus of necessity unlearns reading and writing. Had the totalitarian regime, mainly run by men, persisted much longer, female characters in The Handmaid's Tale, if ever confronted with a book again, might well have regressed to a similar state as that of the medieval monk in the video clip, challenged by the very materiality of the book as an utterly unfamiliar object. Before I delve into the novel itself and examine the crucial status of books and print culture in a social context in which they are for the most part strictly banned, let me first comment on the reception of this particular book and this particular author in the United States. As Caroline Rosenthal has demonstrated in a survey published in 2000, many Americans, especially in earlier decades, have regarded Atwood as a part of American, usually meaning US literature. Atwood herself identifies, of course, first and foremost as a Canadian, yet she may also be regarded as one of Canada's most North American writers, for biographical and literary reasons. For one, she is the quintessential border crosser, both as an individual, often traveling to the United States to give readings and hold lectures, and as a highly productive author, well-versed on the United States in her vast creative and non-fictional oeuvre. It is fair to say that Atwood for long has been one of the severest and most outspoken critics of US politics and social trends. John Updike thus wrote in his 1986 New Yorker review of The Handmaid's Tale, "To Canadians, we must see a violent and somewhat sinister nation. It is a long way atmospherically from Toronto to Detroit. Though sharing a continent, an accent of spoken English, and many assumptions with the United States, and afflicted with its own domestic divisions, our friendly northern neighbor stands above, as it were, much of our moral strenuousness, our noisy determination to combine virtue and power, and our occasional vast miscarriages of missionary intention. Bemusement mixed with dread, detachment, and a sense of superiority animates Miss Atwood's spirited caricature of conditions south of the 49th parallel." She took her master's degree at Radcliffe and finished The Handmaid's Tale in Alabama. Like most of her countrymen, she knows the United States better than we know Canada. As Updike's positive review of the novel suggests, many US intellectuals and readers agree with Atwood's critical diagnosis of their country. After all, she is a best-selling writer and a literary icon in the United States, too. The Handmaid's Tale, her sixth novel, and in terms of its setting, her most American one, marked Atwood's breakthrough abroad, first and foremost in the United States. In fact, the US response to the novel in the reviews was altogether even more positive, more engaged, more sophisticated than the more cautious and more reserved Canadian reception at the time. Almost all reviewers of this dystopian novel also stressed its relevance for the contemporary United States, the years of Ronald Reagan's presidency in the 1980s. For instance, "A must-read for humanists, for everybody really. It's a classic. Read it. It will make you understand why you are opposed to the born-agains who want to return this country to the Christianity of the Bible." Another US reviewer stressed, "I used to think that religion was beyond satire. Margaret Atwood has gloriously, triumphantly proven me wrong. She's a rare and splendid talent, and every intelligent and patriotic American should be grateful to her." Such highly positive US responses to The Handmaid's Tale are due in part to how perceptively and elaborately this dystopia engages in a critical dialogue with US trends of the day and beyond, such as the rise of fundamentalist right-wing religious groups and of televangelism, the backlash against feminism, and cutbacks on environmental programs at the time of the Reagan administration. Edward warned against such social trends by devising an ingenious plot set in the near future of the so-called Republic of Gilead, forcefully established by military power in the wake of air pollution and nuclear and ecological catastrophes, and the resultant widespread sterility and infertility in what used to be the United States of the 20th century. Gilead, a fundamentalist and militarist Puritan theocracy, has abolished the US Constitution and bases its absolutist ideology instead on a literal exegesis of the Old Testament and thereby a book, the Bible, as well as on gender segregation, combining extreme understandings of both to restrict fertile young women to the sole task of bearing children for upper-class couples as a result of very low fertility rates. Biological determinism and an essentialist view of the sexes result in a socially stratified system of castes, with the power positions reserved for men and women mainly relegated to the functions of childbearing and domestic work, along with the indoctrinating functions of the so-called aunts and the representative and husband-caring functions of often infertile wives of the often sterile commanders. In a monthly ceremony related to the menstrual cycle, based on a literal reading of Genesis 30 and its reference to vicarious reproduction, the handmaid, as the childbearing slaves are called, lies on her back with her head between the wife's spread legs, while the commander tries to impregnate the handmaid in front of the entire household. With such a reductive, strictly procreation-oriented and subservient view of women held by Gilead society, the handmaids even lose their former individual names and are patronymically renamed after the commanders they serve. In this manner, the narrator is called now Offred, Offred. Women are denied education, property, and jobs. Concerning jobs, exceptions are the Marthas, household workers, and the aunts, who work in the center set up for the indoctrination of the handmaids. As one of the commanders says about women, "Our big mistake was teaching them to read. We won't do that again." The reader is giving a highly restricted yet personal inside view of Gilead, with the inside handmaid's tale constituting a retrospective diary of a surviving handmaid, Offred. It is significant that Offred, in the time before the political takeover, had been surrounded by books and even had made them her profession. Working as a librarian, also fond of books as material objects, Offred was involved in a task that already marked a transition from print culture to electronic or post-print culture, transferring books to computer disks. After the books were transferred, they were supposed to go to the shredder, but sometimes I took them home with me. I liked the feel of them and the look. The reduced replacement costs and the increased ease of electronic handling and storage of mass data have drawbacks, however. The novel shows that with a higher degree of digitalization in everyday life, it becomes easier to appropriate and misuse the electronic media for control, suppression, and indoctrination. Three examples. by means of a simple change in the electronic system, rendering their digital cards useless, women's assets, those bank accounts marked with an F for female, are expropriated on the day of the military takeover. TV is geared towards fundamentalist religious preaching and one-sided political propaganda in the midst of a raging civil war based on religious factions. By means of electronic alarm systems and so-called compute checks, outside physical movement, especially that of the handmaid, is strictly monitored and documented. By contrast, written language and print media are restricted and largely banned in public life. An exception is Soul Scrolls, a store in the city center in which there are rows of printout machines printing out roll upon roll of prayer texts that were ordered by CompuPhone. The more prayers are ordered, often by the commander's wives, the more pious one is considered to be and the better it is for the husband's career. Even with this printing of prayers, though, similarly as with the Bible text during the ceremony, the texts are also read out, here in flat, metallic voices by the machines, while the printouts are then immediately recycled into fresh paper for the next prayer order. Shops where the handmaids buy the food for their households are labeled by pictograms instead of text. Only men and the ants, as an integral part of the power system, are allowed to read, and literacy is in general deliberately limited. For handmaids, books and writing are on a par with razor blades, which could be used for potential suicides, that is, strictly prohibited. In such a medially streamlined social context that methodically restricts access to the written word, it is writing, books, and print culture that become metaphor and medium for the mental, if not physical, survival of the suppressed. Verbally astute Offred is fascinated by and clings steadfastly to language, not least by producing the diary that makes up the main part of Atwood's novel. Under Offred's severely restricted living conditions in Gilead, her narrative becomes a beautifully articulated eulogy of things usually taken for granted. Pleasure is an egg. In particular, a celebration of language and print culture, such as books, of which she feels so dismally deprived. Whereas the electronic appliances in the novel, such as TV, CompuChecks, CompuCounts, and CompuDocs, are associated with Offred's restrictions, suppression, and plight, it is the written word, real, remembered, or imagined, from which Offred derives her hopes and on which she focuses extensively. As to her memories of the time before, she remembers books as the sources of her considerable knowledge. I had a paper due the next day. Psychology, English, economics. We studied things like that then. On the floor of the room there were books, open face down, this way and that, extravagantly. Newspapers and news magazines of the past too, such as Time or Newsweek, are described as sources of knowledge, and in fact as existentially vital sources that warned of the upcoming radicalization, as well as the increase in violence by men against women. Yet such warnings were not heeded. Read by the protagonist together with her husband Luke with coffee in bed on Sunday morning, quote, "The newspaper stories were like dreams to us, bad dreams dreamt by others," unquote. Under the nightmarish conditions of Gilead, when Offred wonders whether her husband is still alive, she daydreams of a written note by him, hopefully telling her that all will eventually be well. Significantly, she dreams of such a sign of life of him, presumably dead, as being slipped into my hand as I reach the tokens across the counter in all flesh, the name of the butcher's shop. In the new social context of highly regulated pictorial signs, it is thus an imagined written message that becomes the source of Offred's hope. It's this message, which may never arrive, that keeps me alive. Quite in contrast to the bad news, for instance, of the political takeover, the subsequent civil war, and the death of her mother in the deadly colonies, all of which reach the narrator via images on TV. Offred states on TV in general terms, "This sounded false, improbable, like something you would say on television." Electronic and print media thus largely have constructive symbolic value in this book, which did not prevent the novel to be adapted into an extremely successful American TV series in 2017, which has won 11 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes and has already been renewed for a 3rd season. Next to Donald Trump's inauguration as President of the United States in the same year, this Yulu TV series set off another surge of worldwide reception of this novel, so much so that it may be considered a cult book by now. In the daily routine of life in Gilead, Offred yearns for books as repositories of knowledge that could satisfy her constant curiosity. The only 2 written statements initially available to her in her Spartan room combine as symbols for her balancing and ambivalence between outward acquiescence and passivity on the one hand, and her inward protest and rebellion against the theocratic regime on the other. On the cushion in her room, the word faith is stitched in capital letters. Contrastingly, hidden low on the wooden cupboard wall in a dark corner, a text in tiny script in mock incorrect Latin was supposedly scratched by a previous handmaid living in the room. Nolite te bastardes carborundorum, translated by the commander in the novel when Offred asks him for a translation as, "Don't let the bastards grind you down." Ironically, an enduring encouragement to resist the sexist regime which buttresses the narrator's inner opposition. Offred's narration also stresses that access to the written word correlates with power and thereby with gender in Gilead. The Bible is officially the most important book, and it is an irony that a society that bans books is based upon the authority of one book, taken literally and absolutely. But this book is locked away, and only the commander may read from it to the assembled household at the monthly ceremony. Quote, "He has something we don't have. He has the word," unquote. The commander in power also gets away with breaking the very rules he himself was instrumental in setting up. Thus, it is actually forbidden for the commander and the handmaid to meet or have any interaction with one another outside their monthly insemination attempts at the ceremony. Yet before long, the commander has Offred join him in his private study after dinner 2 or 3 times per week, at a time when his wife will not notice. Not for any sexual relations in private, as it turns out, but to talk. And, to the terrified handmaid's utter amazement, to play Scrabble. Offred's emotional turmoil during her first nightly visit in the commander's study is heightened by some of the normal life objects she sees in his room, above all a desk with a pen holder set and books that he has saved from the time before. But all around the walls there are bookcases. They're filled with books. Books and books and books, right out in plain view. No locks, no boxes. No wonder we can't come in here. It's an oasis of the forbidden. I try not to stare. Offred's attraction to books and writing, intensified by her long deprivation of both, is further broken down to individual letters and the spelling of individual words in the Scrabble games, where her inventiveness with words shows her intense involvement with language and her high level of education. The counters representing letters are in fact referred to in a sensual, even sensuous manner. We play two games, larynx, I spell, valance, quince, zygote. I hold the glossic counters with their smooth edges, finger the letters. The feeling is voluptuous. This is freedom, an eye blink of it. Limp, I spell, gorge, what a luxury. The counters are like candies, made of peppermint, cool like that. I would like to put them into my mouth. They would also taste of lime, the letter C, crisp, slightly acid on the tongue, delicious. At the second meeting and after playing Scrabble again, the commander surprises the handmaid by announcing a present to her, which turns out to be an issue of the women's glossy magazine Vogue from the 1970s, also totally forbidden now. Staring at the magazine, as he dangled it before me like fish bait, I wanted it. I wanted it with a force that made the ends of my fingers ache. At the same time, I saw this longing of mine as trivial and absurd, because I'd taken such magazines lightly once. I took the magazine from him. Offred becomes aware of the essence of such magazines, something she needs now more than ever before. What was in them was promise. They dealt in transformations. They suggested an endless series of possibilities. The real promise in them was immortality. As I have demonstrated, the few surviving instances of writing and print culture in this dystopian novel mostly function as nostalgic remnants of a highly desirable lost past. They uphold a link to history in a totalitarian political context that drastically attempts to suppress written documents of the past apart from the Bible, and thereby any historical consciousness also of different life options in order to erase and totally reconstruct identities, especially of women. Largely deprived of written texts, the narrator realizes the value of these texts for the formation, transfer, and preservation of knowledge, books, for intellectual games, challenges, and exchange of ideas, Scrabble, and for social and personal identity construction, magazines. Yet, taking this a step further, Atwood adds some 14 pages of historical notes on The Handmaid's Tale, which form a coda to the inset narration of The Handmaid. The historical notes are prefaced by the following information. Being a partial transcript of the proceedings of the 12th Symposium on Gileadian Studies, held as part of the International Historical Association Convention, which took place at the University of Dinai Nunavut. Yes, some noted the wordplay, Dinai Nunavut, on June 25th, 2195. Taking a significant leap in narrated time, the plot is thus prolonged by some 200 years to the end of the 22nd century, when the oppressive Gilead regime is a thing of the past. By rendering verbatim the introduction to, and then the talk of the history professor James Darcy Peixoto of Cambridge University, England, on problems of authentication in reference to The Handmaid's Tale, Atwood not only satirizes rituals of academic conferences, as well as university professors. She also dishearteningly shows that sexist aspects of gender relations, though in a more padded and civilized form, have survived the fall of Gilead and the Gilead regime. And she indirectly, in fictionalized terms, gives her readers a kind of manual. Compare the end of the manual in the earlier video clip. So gives her readers a kind of manual on how to read and deal with the Handmaid's narrative, or rather, considering the misogynist professor, how he goes about it in his conference talk, on how not to deal with the Handmaid's narration. As Arnold Davidson states, in crucial ways, the episode is the most pessimistic part of the book. But I want to focus here on the very mediality on the narrative as it is elucidated in the professor's fictional talk, in the professor's talk at the end of the novel. He explains to his audience that the text of what his co-editor, a Cambridge colleague, entitled The Handmaid's Tale, was transcribed, ordered, structured, annotated, and published by himself and his co-editor based on some 30 audio tapes that were, quote, unearthed on the site of what was once the city of Bangor in what would have been the state of Maine, unquote. At least 150 years after the tapes must have been put there. In other words, in a medial extension of the literary convention of the found manuscript, Offred had originally spoken her narrative onto numerous tapes, her chunks of text embedded in pop, rock, and folk music, probably for camouflage purposes. The tapes were unnumbered and were thus reconstructed and sequenced by the two scholars who claimed to have transcribed her oral narrative in print as faithfully as possible from the taped original. The novel as a whole is thus constructed as two narrative blocks of supposedly transcribed, thus originally oral texts. The Handmaid's Tale as such, and the professor's academic paper on this tale. I cannot here attend to the many repercussions that the information revealed in the appended historical notes has for the inserted tale by the handmaid. But I want to stress that this transfer of oral narration to written text ties in with Atwood's medial considerations and negotiations in this novel. First of all, the inset Handmaid's Tale in its original oral conception may be called a post-print text because it was recorded on an electronic medium. Francis Blouin, for one, proposed in 1996 that post-print culture is the term for our current electronic age. In Offred's Hideaway, which was probably provided by the underground resistance movement on her way to Canada, after her deportation from the commander's house, the tape recorder, for want of available writing equipment, has the important function of documenting and storing audio information. A further reason for the inset Handmaid's Tale qualifying as a post-print text is that it was originally created in a post-print culture in which writing and reading were largely forbidden, especially for women. Valerie Martin, in her introduction to the 2006 Everyman's Library edition, refers even to the novel as such, as a reconstructed post-print novel, in spite of it being undoubtedly a printed and bound material object. Debatable as this designation may be, it stresses the crucial relevance the electronic media have in the novel. And yet, it is by writing down the oral account, assigning a certain order to the taped installments, and making the reconstructed text available to a readership, thus enforcing an objectifying distance between author and reader, that the text may be thoroughly analyzed and distributed. The resulting book thereby contributes to knowledge formation about history, becomes a part of collective memory and in the present context functions as a warning of undesirable future developments. The survival evoked in the title of my lecture also applies to this context of preserving information by setting it down on paper. While the oral version of a narrative, her act of speaking her thoughts onto audio tapes, keeps Offred going under life-threatening circumstances, in the final analysis, it is the written version that guarantees her existence. One could argue even further that by having the handmaid speak her narrative onto tape and only later having it put into writing by scholars, Atwood in fictional terms addresses some tenets of media history, such as the primacy of oral storytelling over written literature. As Walter Ong reminds us, written narrative at first was merely a transcription of oral narrative, or what was imagined as oral narrative. Atwood's fictional professor Peek Soto, with his transcription, evokes, in Ong's terms, the first age of writing, the age of scribes, writers of orally conceived discourse. The professor, as far as his transcription work is concerned, is not yet a true author from the next stage of writing, namely a person who composed in writing and later for print. It would seem that Atwood's novel on a symbolic level also participates in a medial discourse on the objectifying potential inherent in writing, which according to Ong was finally realized in print. Print maximized the conversion of the living, evanescent sound of words into the quasi-permanence of visual space, suggesting a further step towards secondary or electronic orality developed within literary cultures. The professor's reconstruction of Offred's taped narrative segments as a transformation from oral to written tale qualifies as what Ong calls the talked book, which is a printed book based on an earlier taped talk. Ong, like Atwood, stresses that the electronic media are working not at all to destroy books, but to produce different books. And the novel in this case features, for instance, characteristics of oral language. At yet a further level of significance, considering the novel as such as a printed text within literary history, The Handmaid's Tale by now belongs to the canon of Canadian, North American, and world literature. Valerie Martin in 2006 called it the instant classic. This best and long seller, Atwood's most read and most frequently taught book, has also managed what books of fiction achieve all too rarely. The novel, though certainly buttressed by its recent highly successful TV adaptation, has entered and influenced the public political discourse. See, for instance, the women's marches and public protests against Trump and Co., with references to Atwood's novel displayed all over the world. At a time that is witnessing an increase in dangerous political leaders, simplistic responses to increasingly complex social and environmental problems, and infamous alternative facts, in the public discourse, The Handmaid's Tale is rightly seen as a condemnation of systematic oppression and discrimination based on gender, race, or any other aspect of political and religious ideology. As the rigid sorting of characters according to a strict color code in the novel indicates, the book also warns against viewing people and the world by means of overly simplistic schemes, or tweets, we might add today. As if all that were not enough, this complex and multifaceted novel, which represents a special kind of historiographic metafiction, a term coined in Canada in 1984 by Linda Hutchin, in various ways, as I have shown, is also a timeless celebration of language. In times of a rapid increase of the digitalization of information, the novel insists on the indispensability of the written word, of print culture, and the printed book.